Now, is that a Pittsburgh Pirates hat?
It is. Does it offend you?
Not at all. I just wondered why you would have a Pittsburgh Pirates hat.
Because I have an addiction, and my addiction is to caps. You see behind?
Oh, I see. See my caps? Yeah, I see a bunch.
Hang on, look, see? Now, if it did offend you, I can change it around a bit. There's your White Sox. I also like, there's your Los Angeles. So you can pick. There's your Houston Astros. There's your Baltimore Orioles. What do you
look
got there?
What I've got.
Oh. No, I don't have one of those. And I don't know. Are they? I like to collect minor league teams. So these are all minor league teams. Columbia, the Storm Chasers, and the Aberdeen. That's the Aberdeen Iron Eagles, wherever that is in America. I don't have a Scientology cap. No, I certainly don't. I don't know if I want one. But is that considered a minor league team or a major league team, a Scientology team?
It's a Bush League.
They'd probably consider themselves major league.
Yeah, exactly.
Everybody
else is their Bush League.
Hey, look,
so are you in Auckland?
I'm actually in Dunedin. Because you're an Aussie,
really?
Eh? I know you're like Australia. I see on your profile Australian American, but you're born in Aussie. You're an Adelaide boy, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. I am.
Yeah.
I still watch Aussie rules. I still watch rugby league. I still watch the cricket. That stuff never gets beaten out of you, I guess.
So the most important question then, obviously, is how do you feel about Australia not making it to the quarterfinals of their own T20 Cricket World Cup?
Pretty shitty.
And
but,
the second,
but they're gonna win the Rugby League World Cup.
Yeah.
That was a good game against New Zealand, though.
Yeah,
like a really, really, that was probably the best game of the whole tournament and should have been the final.
Yep. Yeah, well, Samoa was interesting though. How well they've been performing in that as well.
Yeah, I know. Well, I think they're a bit flash in the pan. I mean, they got beaten 66-6 by England, and then came back and turned it around and beat them just.
Yeah.
A golden point. I don't think they're going to beat Australia though.
No, I would agree with you. And I'm now interested also in how many of your American interviews you've talked about rugby league and cricket. That's interesting.
None.
To me as well.
Not a one.
Hey, welcome to the South Pacific.
Exactly. Yeah, no,
I'm in Dunedin. I'm born and bred in Auckland, but I've been in Dunedin for a decade now. So,
oh.
Yeah.
You, but this you like it down there?
Love it. Love Dunedin. Love it to bits. But I'm not one of those people who moves away from the big earth smoke and go, oh, fuck that place. I'm not going back there because I still like Auckland, still got family in Auckland, go back up there regularly. I've always said I could live in Auckland again, you know, should there be a work or something necessity, but I have no ambition to go back to Auckland because I love Dunedin.
So this is where
I am. This is where I'll happily stay forevermore should that be as the tea leaves are placed before me.
Well, I have some very dear friends who moved very near to you fairly recently.
Oh, nice. For what reason? Why did they move?
They bought a piece of land and built a house.
Oh, nice.
On top of a hill overlooking the ocean.
Oh, very good. Are they New Zealand friends or are they internationals?
No, the husband is a New Zealander.
Right.
The wife is American.
Yeah, very good. So when you say very close, I'm thinking Central Otago. That's the
You know, I'm not even sure exactly where it is. They just told me, you know, it's South Island, you know, East Coast, in the middle somewhere, you know.
Hey, well, let's talk about that for a sec because, you know, we're talking to you because of your involvement, very high up involvement with Scientology. And one of the things I was going to ask you about, which makes sense to ask you now, seeing we're talking about Aotearoa, New Zealand, is I thought about it this morning and I went, Scientology never really got a hold in New Zealand. But I guess the response to my own question is it probably never actually really got a hold anywhere. It has the appearance of getting a hold in Los Angeles, but actually numbers-wise, it never really got anywhere. But I read today, just for the first time, that the New Zealand chapter of Scientology was the first international chapter outside of America. So it's interesting that New Zealand has sort of a quote-unquote special place to play in Scientology's history, but it still never really got any traction.
Right. And you're exactly right. I was going to say, I didn't know if you were aware of this, Pat, but New Zealand was one of the first places outside of the United States that Scientology sort of established an organization. The organization that was established there in whenever it was, 1956 or 55, okay, yeah, is about the same size today as it was then, except they now own a bigger, emptier building.
Yeah,
and that's sort of true pretty much around the world. I guess Scientology kind of had its heyday in in the 80s. It grew through the 60s and 70s as sort of a, I don't know, it was like a counterculture thing. You know, Scientology was unpopular with the government, and that made it popular with hippies.
Yeah.
You know, if the government hated you, then we love you.
And yeah, yeah.
If you present yourself as something new and different, that was pretty cool back then. And yeah. So there are a lot of people that came into Scientology in the 60s and 70s, and it sort of continued to grow through the 80s, and it's been on a decline since then, but more sharply over the last 10, 15 years, sort of coincident with the growth of the internet and the information age,
yeah,
making, you know, information is poison to cults. It kills cults. And the information available on the internet and then through the media, you know, there was a big series that was done by two incredible reporters at the St. Pete Times in 2009. And, you know, which I talk about in my book, it was sort of the thing that started me on my course of whistleblowing activity. But then subsequent to that was Going Clear, which had a massive impact, both the book and the HBO documentary. And then the, you know, Scientology in the Aftermath series that Leah and I did for 3 years was just sort of a constant every week. Here's a new story of abuse and horrors inside Scientology. And I guess the thing about it was that it was pretty relentless, and also that it was really hard for Scientology to say, you know, every one of those people is a bullshitter, faker, just making this stuff up, because you watch them and you go, there's no way that this is faked. And yeah, everybody has these horrible experiences, and there are so many of them that it can't all be, you know, just crap. And that's what Scientology had said for so long. You know, every person who ever said anything they didn't like was just a liar, an apostate, you know, we threw them out for being unethical, whatever. And that, I guess the aftermath kind of put an end to that line having any sort of traction at all.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, I have to say, I was deep into, look, I'm a fan of, you know, religions and behind the religions and what's been going on. I've done it for a long time. I love looking into it, you know, whether it was the Panorama documentary on Scientology, or whether it was Louis Theroux, or whether it was this as well. I've just been in love with sort of the concept of understanding this more and more and more. And I wonder if a part of the, you know, the stopping, the stopping of the making of that series was because the story was told. But part of me is like, it's one of those series and I'm like, I want more. You know, why isn't there more? Even though the stories were obviously similar to the, you know, the abuse and that sort of thing, but it's like, it just felt like it could go for so much longer. What was the rationale behind, okay, we've done our bit, we're wrapping up and moving on now?
Okay, well, there's really two things, Pat. One, we started having difficulty because, and this gets a little sort of inside baseball, but the network didn't ever want us to be the crusading champions. They wanted us to be the documentarians.
Right.
And it became increasingly difficult because they would say to us, well, okay, so you know, we had various episodes where we took people to law enforcement or went and saw the police or went and saw lawyers or this or that. And they're like, no, 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 you can't do that. You know, you have to be, you can do that if you're documenting what other people are doing, but you got
to, you can't be the ones,
you can't
to do
be
it.
The ones that are doing it. And we started saying, well, wait a minute, we are the ones that are doing it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, what do you want us to do? I mean, we're doing this stuff. You're telling us, and we even shot a bunch of it, and you're telling us we can't use that footage. And we went, eh, okay. Well, this seems like a kind of, we can't just keep doing the same thing over and over and over. So then what we did was we were out like selling a sort of a different message, and trying to go to streaming services that don't have advertisers, that don't, like, there was always this problem with A&E because their advertisers supported their network, and so they get pressure from advertisers, blah 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 blah. Anyway, so when we were in the midst of doing that, COVID hit,
right?
And nobody was doing TV. Nobody was shooting any TV shows whatsoever anywhere for any reason under the sun. So it just sort of died. Okay. And it's not that, you know, Leah and I wouldn't do another show. We just would like to do something that's now takes us to another level. And, and you know, that,
what would that be? What would the next level be? Like, you've started telling stories. What is the next level? You've been telling people stories and exposing things. So what's, you know, Aftermath 2.0, what's that level look like?
What I would like is, I would like to be documenting the activism. I would like to be actually going to politicians and briefing them and demanding that they do something. And, you know, getting them involved. I'd like to be going to law enforcement. I'd like to be going, you know, we would love to be able to go and start doing educational programs for law enforcement and politicians and other people, because, you know, we did an episode that was very eye-opening for us with a captain from the San Francisco Police Department. You may, if you've seen it, you may remember her. A black woman who had been at Jonestown, and her story was incredible. Her story about her life was remarkable, and many remarkable similarities to Scientology as well. But off camera, we talked to her a great deal about what's the problem with law enforcement. And she kept saying to us, look, they just don't understand. They don't understand. They're not used to dealing with people who are being mentally imprisoned and controlled, and you have to know how to deal with those sort of people in order to be properly doing your job as a police officer. Right. And without understanding that, police just fail. And, you know, we had that occur with us, where we documented Heba Jentsch, the president of the Church of Scientology International, who'd been incarcerated in the hole and was at the being held at the Gold Base up there in Riverside, California. And one of his nieces reached out to us and said, I want to go do a welfare check on Heba. And we said, great. She said, will you come with me? Will you? And we said, look, we absolutely, Tammy, we will come with you. We will support you all the way. We can't do anything. All we can do is have cameras there and sort of be watching you do your thing. And, you know, what happened was, because she kicked up a stink and because we had cameras there, the sheriff's office decided that they would go out and do a quote welfare check. They wouldn't let her do it. She was not able to talk to her uncle. But two police officers went and they came back and they said, oh yeah, he's great. Well, he was in a room inside the building with two minders, present when the police were talking to him, and they didn't know and weren't clued in enough to go, we need to take anybody in this circumstance outside of the zone of control of these people and talk to them alone and tell them that they are free to come with us without anybody else around who could possibly influence them. And, you know, this is sort of a part of the problem of dealing with organizations like Scientology or, you know.
But it is so funny, because if you were to say this person is being abused by these people, I think about like an abused wife. Mm-hmm. The police wouldn't turn up into a house and talk to the wife while the alleged abused husband was sitting there. They'd go, okay, we're going to talk to her by herself. So why, if that's the natural thing to do in that situation, it just seems logical that that's what they would do. In the other situation, if the nieces said, it's the people who are in that building who are abusing him.
Right. Well, this is where you get into problems of them not understanding cults. And particularly you get into problems in the United States, where there is a lot of law that exists about the First Amendment and the separation of church and state and government intrusion into religious activities. And government agencies are scared of entangling themselves in religious activities. So they walk on, you know, on 10 to feet to do, get them to do anything. And that was, it was all particularly exacerbated by the Branch Davidian Waco fiasco, where the FBI sort of barged in, and by barging in with guns drawn, hundreds of women and children died in a blazing inferno that probably, almost certainly, could have been avoided. And at that point, U.S. government agencies went, oh my God, we have to be super, we have to just like tiptoe around on these subjects. And that's, you know, it's not unique to the United States, but it certainly is exacerbated here by the laws that exist with respect to government agencies versus religion.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Hey, listen, we should probably also let people know one of the reasons. I'd talk to you any day for any reason, Mike, as I said, in the weeds about this. But one of the reasons we're talking to you and the way we've reached out is for your book that's been released, A Billion Years, My Escape from a Life in the Highest Ranks of Scientology, available in New Zealand. I've just bought up by chance, fishpond.co.nz, if Kiwis want to have a look at it. But obviously, if you're watching this internationally, seeing we are on the old interweb, then available all over the world if you want to check it. And what I thought I'd do today, it's not that I don't want to talk about a lot of the stuff, but because I watch the stuff all the time, I don't feel the need so much to talk about what's the hole and what's a thetan and what's an audit, because they're in every interview. Like, if people want to find out about that, go talk about every interview. But maybe we could get down to a few more of the weeds, and maybe I can be a little bit self-indulgent and ask you some of the questions that I really want to know.
Well, it is your show.
Yeah.
you can ask any question you want, whether I answer them or not. That's a completely different thing. But you know, go for it.
So what people can do is just turn off now, because this was really just a conversation just for me. No one else is going to be interested. But I thought I'd help you, to be arrogant, explain the billion year thing by playing this clip from a investigation in 1973 into Scientology, so people can understand a bit more what the reference to the billion clip was.
Wow. I signed what is a contract. I signed a contract for 1 billion years. Now, I worked on the average approximately 16 hours per day, 7 days a week, for $9.60 a week.
John McClane became part of the Scientology Sea Organization, or Sea Org, and served aboard Hubbard's ship.
I believed in Scientology and in the truth that I saw. Therefore, I was willing to do it right up until I actually made my final decision to leave.
This 1 billion year contract would appear to be, legally, an unconscionable document. The implication is that the signer will continue to serve the organization in future lives.
So there you go. Is that a pretty good explanation as to the billion-year contract? What do you want to add to that, Mike?
Terrific explanation. Nobody really believes that's an enforceable legal document. It is not, obviously. You can't enforce a contract for a billion years. But in the minds of Scientologists, just like John McLean said there, you believe that this is an obligation you have made that is perhaps more binding and more important than any legal document could be. This is your commitment to achieving the aims of Scientology for your entire eternity, because it's that important. Yeah. And you know, you feel a real obligation to not bail out or abandon the commitment that you've made.
Yeah.
You know, you could say that a marriage license is a legal document, and of course it is, much more so than a billion-year contract, but what keeps people together isn't the legality of it, it's their personal integrity or what they believe is the right thing to do, or
the
commitment
intention
that they've made to the other person.
Yeah.
And that's what the hold of the billion-year contract is. And you know, a lot of my book details the beginning and then the growing questioning or worrying or concern about what was happening, and the justifications and explanations and reasons why I didn't leave for, you know, so long. Because, you know, if I look back on it, like I say in the beginning of the book, if I knew then what I know now, none of this would have happened. So
yeah, right.
But that commitment is a very, very serious thing in the minds of a Scientologist, and particularly someone who joins what's called the Sea Organization by signing this billion-year contract.
I find it fascinating that you talk about with more information being out there, because I guess I started picking up on investigating into being interested in why people believe what they believe. It's kind of a core as to what I've always been as a broadcaster. I want to understand why you believe that, even if I disagree with it. So that's sort of what mm-hmm. drives me in a lot of these conversations. Because ever since I was been looking at it, I'm just like, what the fuck is this all about? In fact, I even found, and I've told you about this, but just I'd be interested to get you to expand on it, that whilst doing a little bit of reading around for this conversation, I'm listed on the Xenu Wikipedia page, and I had no idea that I'm on the Xenu Wikipedia page. And that's because in 2009, when I was looking around about this, I interviewed the head of Scientology in New Zealand, a guy called Mike Ferris. And what I did was I actually played him this piece of audio.
And they had elected a fellow by the name of Xenu, could be spelled X-E-M-U, to the Supreme Ruler. And they were about to unelect him. And he took the last moments he had in office to really goof the floof. Yes, I don't blame you for dropping something. And
so I played in that piece of audio because it was at that time where Scientology was saying, oh, this Xenu thing, it's so weird, it's so strange. And I just said to him, well, I mean, it actually quotes here what I said. I'm not listed as the reference of this, but this was me. I said to him, well, if it's not anything to do with it, why is L. Ron Hubbard talking about it? He gave me an answer, and I said this, as it says here on there. This is what I said to Mike Ferris. So what you're saying is Xenu is a part of the religion, but something you don't want to talk about. And his response was, sure. And then he acknowledged that Xenu was a part of the esoterica of Scientology. So this bit here, in November 2009, the Church of Scientology's representative in New Zealand, Mike Ferris, was asked in a radio interview about Xenu. That was my radio interview. So it was bizarre to me that, not by name, but I'm listed on the Xenu website as the reference when Mike Ferris finally acknowledged it. And I remember, I think he was called the Beard of Knowledge. A guy called Mark Bunker or
Wise Beard Man.
Wise Beard Man. He had a blog at the time.
Yeah.
And that went ballistic because it was finally someone from Scientology acknowledging Xenu was a thing in the religion.
Right.
I don't know what my question is about this, but it's the one of the things I've discovered in doing this is this. What was the reaction? What would have been the reaction to that by, I'm not saying you heard about that, but by Scientology when it was finally outed that Xenu was a real thing? This was probably after South Park as well.
Yeah. The reaction was freak out. And the reason why this is such a freaky subject in Scientology, and I talk about this in the book, Pat. I talk about an interview I did with Katie Couric on NBC National TV where she asked me about this.
Hmm.
But Hubbard convinced Scientologists that this story of Xenu and the intergalactic transportation of, you know, disembodied beings 75 million years ago, dumped in volcanoes and blown up with H-bombs and blah, 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 was a real thing.
As represented by South Park, if people are watching right now.
Exactly. And that South Park representation is basically pretty much word for word what Hubbard says.
Yep.
And you know, it's got that big capitalized, this is what Scientologists actually believe, and it is.
Yep.
And he convinced Scientologists that this was, you know, he announced it in 1967 in this very, very famous recording that he did called Ron's Journal 67. And Scientologists to this day sort of revere this as Hubbard announcing that he has discovered the secret to the everything bad that has ever happened to planet Earth and the people on planet Earth. And it was a catastrophic event that occurred 75 million years ago, and that he is the first person who has ever been able to uncover what happened, and having uncovered it, survived it. And he announced to Scientologists that it almost killed him.
Right.
That his research into this almost killed him. Well, his research was complete baloney, but he then said in the written materials of OT3, which is what this is called, the Wall of Fire, one of the higher levels of Scientology that you have to pay a lot of money to get to, that if you were exposed to these materials before you were spiritually ready for them, i.e. you had paid for and taken all the necessary steps before that, that it literally could result in you dying. You, at a minimum, would probably get terrible pneumonia. You would be, you know, sort of in a vegetative state almost. It would destroy you and possibly kill you. And Scientologists believe that.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not sure how many of them do because so much of it has been out in public. But up until that point, if this ever came up in public and was, you know, someone brought it up, the standard response was, well, no, that you don't have it right. Like,
well, there's or something hang on, that or the, you, or the other response, and this is what Mike said to me as well, is, are you trying to offend me? When I asked him that question, his response was, are you trying to offend me? Which was my response was, no, I'm trying to learn about your beliefs. And if this is part of your beliefs, I want to learn about it.
Yeah, well, you realize that at that time, Mike Ferris was almost certainly had not even gotten to that level in Scientology. So he had no idea. The vast majority of people who are the spokespersons for Scientology have no clue.
Why would he have acknowledged it? It's secret to them. That he wouldn't have known. Why did he say yes? It's a part of the religion. Then, if he had,
because you played him L. Ron Hubbard saying that, like L. Ron Hubbard's words are the words of God. They are they are unalterable. They are unquestionable. You cannot do, say, or think anything that might even question the words of L. Ron Hubbard. So he was in a tough spot.
Right.
You know, it's possible that back then he had reached that level. I just doubt it.
Right.
And it's particularly... It's sort of convenient for a lot of these spokespeople to go, when asked about it, I have no idea what you're talking about. And plausible they really don't. And they really go, I've never heard about this in Scientology. And they really haven't. It's so secret inside Scientology. When you read these materials and they're in Hubbard's handwriting, you are in a locked room with someone standing over you to make sure that you don't steal them. You know, it's like, it's really a lot of bullshit. And now, after so many years, back when you first did that, and like in the mid-90s, this became a real problem in Scientology, because someone leaked stuff onto the fledgling internet, and that just created a fiasco for Scientology. And since that time, it's, you know, now you can find this stuff everywhere.
But it is different, isn't it? Because, and again, referencing that interview, he basically was like, every religion has things it doesn't want to talk about. And I went, well, you know, I grew up in the Catholic Church. What are you talking about? And he was like, angels and demons. And I'm like, eh. I guess that's true. You know, if someone interacting with a Christian church for the first time gets told about demons and hell and, you know, all this kind of stuff, it might be a bit freaky. But the difference is you can actually go to a Christian church today where that's all they talk about, you know, like a Pentecostal church, that's all they talk about. So I didn't talk to him about that, but it's like, I can see how someone, like every aspect of magical thinking, whether it's religion or whether it's an Eastern philosophy or whatever, has some things that are a bit kind of embarrassing about it. So what's the difference? And even though I don't want to go over the basics, you know, just to say quite quickly who Xenu is, do you want to give us a sentence or two on Xenu, seeing we're talking about Xenu? But then what's the difference between the fear around the release of Xenu and, let's say, the fear around the release of, I don't know, Catholic boy, the Holy Spirit. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay, well, first of all, Xenu was supposedly this galactic overlord that ruled a confederation of planets 75 million years ago and tried to solve the problem of overpopulation by taking all these people, killing them, stealing their spirits, freezing them in glycol, transporting them to the planet Earth on spaceships that look like DC-8s, dropping them into volcanoes, and blowing up hydrogen bombs on them.
Yeah.
And if that sounds bizarre, it's because it is. And Hubbard, you know, he was a science fiction writer, and it is pulp science fiction at its very finest. That is what it is. What the difference, Pat, is with Scientology is Scientology claims there is no faith involved in Scientology.
Okay.
Scientology is proven, researched, scientific fact that L. Ron Hubbard discovered all these things and that they are what he called a technology. They are not a faith. They are a technology. So if you do what he says exactly, you will get the same result every time, and it will be exactly as promised.
Which is also the big out. Because therefore, if it doesn't work for you, well, you didn't do it exactly like you were supposed to. So that's on you, not me.
You are so right. Even beyond that, there is this sort of long pattern starting in 1950 with Hubbard. His first book was called Dianetics, the Modern Science of Mental Health. It wasn't really his first one, but the first one that really became a seller and put his name on the map, promised that if you followed the steps that he laid out in Dianetics, you would be a sort of perfect computing human who had no illnesses, didn't even get a cold, cured yourself of blindness. You know, if you were crippled, you'd start walking. I mean, the claims in Dianetics, which are still in there to this day, are beyond anything that you could possibly imagine from just the regular run-of-the-mill faith healer. And the promise is, do this exactly as I say, and all of this will be solved. Well, when that didn't happen, and nobody was able to achieve these things that he claimed could be achieved, he then said, oh, well, I've been doing more research. Now, we need to, you know, Dianetics was just about the mind. Now we need to address the spiritual being, which in Scientology is called a Thetan. He called it a Thetan for no real good reason, just a word. And we are now going to address the Thetan. And that's what Scientology, that's he. So he started Scientology. And if by addressing the Thetan, who is senior to the mind and the body, we will now be able to achieve what we set out to achieve with Dianetics. We just had this unknown thing. And when the first shit from Scientology didn't work, it would be, okay, now I've discovered the next thing that nobody knows about. And, you know, all the way up to discovering Xenu. I mean, every step of the way was, look, the carrot was dangled, promising X. X didn't materialize. So now we've got a new carrot, a little more money, and now we'll achieve Y. And once we've achieved Y, X will obviously be a part of that too. And that is the story of Scientology from the day it started until the day Hubbard died.
We kind of started the segment of the conversation talking about information getting out there. And like I said, if I started looking at it and halfway through last two decades ago now, I guess, I had all the information because the internet was a thing. So it seemed ridiculously easy to me. But I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, Leah Remini's kind of revelation was when she got given those documents to look at as to who Xenu was, and she was like, what the fuck is this lunacy? I think I've heard her tell that story, maybe on Joe Rogan's podcast. I'm wondering, when people get to that level and they finally get to see those documents as to who this intergalactic emperor is, what percentage of them are then so bought in they keep on going? And what kind of percentage of them go, this is lunacy at that point? Like, did most keep on going through?
Very high percentage. Right. And okay. I'll tell you why, Pat. Because Hubbard had another stroke of evil genius. He developed or stole this thing called the E-meter. The E-meter is a pretty, it's just a Wheatstone bridge. It measures electrical resistance.
It's like a lie detector almost, isn't it?
Yes. Hubbard said it was an advanced lie detector. You know, really it's sort of a crude lie detector.
Yeah.
But either way, Hubbard convinced Scientologists that the E-meter, which certainly does measure electrical resistance. And, you know, you hold these two cans and there is this little current that is passed through your body and the E-meter reacts to the changes in resistance of the electrical current passing through your body. Mm-hmm. And it does do that. And there is no question that any change on the little needle on the E-meter is reflecting a change in the resistance in your body, the electrical resistance in your body. What causes that is a very open question. Hubbard claimed that it was caused by thought and your emotions that are below your conscious level of awareness.
Right.
And he has convinced all Scientologists, and they believe this 100%, and this is a scientific instrument and a provable. This is no matter of faith. This is a little box with a needle in it and it measuring this stuff. He has convinced Scientologists that because it reads and registers below your level of awareness, if there is something on the E-meter that is reacting and you go, I haven't got a clue what that's about, you can be guided and steered into, okay, well, tell me what you were thinking. Oh, yeah, that's it. That's it. Yeah, it must be that. And Scientologists go, okay, so the meter has helped me discover something that I was not aware of, and the meter never lies. So you get to OT3, and this is what happens. You read this stuff, and you look up wide-eyed at the person standing over you who is there to make sure that you don't freak out or that you don't steal the materials. And they say, you don't have to believe it. What does the meter tell you? So you sit down on an e-meter.
Like immediately?
You know, it can be immediate. Okay, it can be, or, you know, later that afternoon or the next day or whatever. And you start reading this stuff and you see these reactions. Now, is the reaction because that's actually truth? Or is the reaction your rejection of, oh my God, this is so fucking nuts, it just is crazy? Or is the reaction, I don't know, I just got bit by a mosquito on my neck? Or, I don't know, but to a Scientologist, if there is a reaction on the e-meter, that is good enough as proof that this must be true, and I am just not yet aware enough to be able to understand and duplicate it.
It's the authority figure of the person reading the e-meter telling you what you need to know because you're not advanced enough yet to understand it, and they can guide you through, and then you believe it.
Yes. And, you know, oddly, when you get to that level, you do the e-meter yourself. You don't even have someone. You are now so committed to the idea that the meter is infallible that you actually audit yourself with the meter telepathically. Right. You talk to yourself and watch the reactions on the meter.
Hey, just to wrap up with the South Park conversation as well, I would think that people outside Scientology, most people sort of accept that there's this crazy religion and this is what they believe. Is it now within the church accepted that that's the common belief outside, and that people within the church now believe that that's a part, even if they're not at that level, that that's a part of the religion? Or is it still being denied from within the church as well?
I would be pretty sure that it's being denied from within the church. Like the common line that used to be fed to Scientologists back when this first started coming up was, look, this is altered stuff. Yeah. When you are ready and you get to OT3, you will get the full story. Because this is not... And look, to some extent, there is some truth to that. Because the story of Xenu doesn't do anything for anyone. It's then Hubbard says, so this is what you've got to do to resolve this great, momentous disaster. And that... Because of that thing that happened 75 million years ago, you have thousands or millions of disembodied thetans stuck to your body, and they're called body thetans. And you have to get rid of all those by addressing each one with auditing and, you know, reliving their experiences until they go, oh, I'm gone, and they leave. And so the story of Xenu doesn't tell you anything about how to deal with the problem created by Xenu. That's the technology that Hubbard discovered. He first discovered the story by recalling it, and then discovered the technology of what you do to resolve it. And
handy, eh? Handy he found that just afterwards. That's quite a lucky break.
It was a great break. It was a great break for mankind. One small step.
Hey, Mike, here's one other thing. Yeah. So you were obviously in leadership when that South Park episode dropped. Yeah. What happened behind closed doors the day after, the morning after that South Park episode dropped?
I wish I could recall that sort of detail in my life, Pat, but I can tell you that there had been a lot of time, effort, blood, sweat, tears, and pain that had gone into trying to stop that episode from airing. And because we knew that it was coming.
Right.
The reaction to it was sort of stunned silence. And then the sort of party line was, it's just a cartoon. So, you know, it's a cartoon. Nobody can take a cartoon seriously. If Scientology had been smart at that point, yeah, what we would have done was said, listen, we've just hit the big leagues. South Park goes after the Mormons, they go after the Jehovah's Witnesses, they go after, yep, the Catholics, they go after everybody. We are honored to be in the same, you know, included in the same shit fest from the South Park people as everybody else. It just proves that we have hit the mainstream and we're cool.
It's exactly what the Mormon Church did with Book of Mormon. They, right, advertised in the actual the books you got when you walked into Book of Mormon in America. The Mormon Church did a full page advert. So they absolutely just played up to it. They went, these guys are taking the piss. This is who we are. Come say hi. That would have been the smart thing to do.
Yep, exactly. But Scientology has absolutely no sense of humor. It's discouraged to take anything about Scientology lightly in any way, shape, or form, because it is so serious, because it is so important to the salvation of every man, woman, and child on planet Earth in this lifetime and every lifetime into eternity, and you can't make jokes about that.
Yeah, interesting, eh? I wonder if I'm sure it is. The reality is not because of their altruism, but because David Miscavige doesn't want to have to be teased and mocked. It's probably more because there's so many organizations out there doing good work that also have good senses of humor. So it's not like they're mutually exclusive necessarily, but if you take the piss out of someone who's a sociopath, and that, I use that word because I think I've heard you use that word in different interviews, yeah, that person can't have the piss taken out of them, and that might be more the driving force.
Well, it certainly was the case with Hubbard, and it is the case with Miscavige. Neither of them are sort of in the frame of mind that anybody has the right to mock, question, or even doubt them in any way. And that is a... that's an interesting characteristic to have. It's a really, really unhappy way of going through life.
Yeah, frankly. It sounds horrible. I was just saying, before you said an unhappy way to go through life, I'm just thinking, what a horrible way to live. Yeah. To have to be that kind of serious and in control and stuff all the time. It must be incredibly stressful. I wonder if there's a stat that says sociopaths die of heart attacks younger than the most. I'm just thinking about the amount of stress that must constantly put on someone's literal physical body. I don't know.
That's an interesting question. You know, sociopaths are an interesting subject. I talk a lot about it in various interviews that I've done. I talk about it in the book, about this remarkable book I read by Martha Stout, who was a professor at Harvard, called The Sociopath Next Door. I thought that my experiences with David Miscavige were like I had somehow had the misfortune to run into a purple unicorn that was so out there and so unique that nobody could ever understand just how nuts life around this guy was. And I read that book and I went, oh, I get it. There are these sort of people all over the place. And they have the same impact on the people around them, and they are a studyable phenomena, and they have exact sort of characteristics that they share, and holy shit, yep, that's that guy.
Yeah, totally. Hey, I wanted to ask you as well about the litigious nature of Scientology. Not that I'm personally worried about it, but because they don't seem to be as litigious as they once were. And I saw an article the other day that talks about it's basically purely because of Debbie Cook's testimony, that when they got into a courtroom finally and she got to speak these words out in the courtroom, Scientology kind of realized, oh, we don't really want to be involved in these conversations. For people who don't know this, let me play you 30 seconds of what Debbie Cook had to say in court or in this deposition about her experiences with Scientology.
Did you ever begin to receive or were you ever the recipient of any violence?
Yes, I was. One time I was called into a conference room and asked some questions, and he ordered his secretary to slap me, and she slapped me so hard I fell over into the chairs. One time Mr. Miscavige ordered his communicator to break my finger if I didn't answer his question.
You yourself ever...
And then she goes on to the testimony about, did he ever get violence from Miscavige himself? And she says, I think he shook me or something once. But
right.
is that a quintessential moment within Scientology for going, we don't really want to be in courts?
Okay, there's really a couple. Let me back up before that, Pat.
Yep.
There was a pretty infamous article written by Richard Behar in Time Magazine called The Thriving Cult of Greed, Scientology, The Thriving Cult of Greed and Power. And that came out in 1991. And at the time, we sued Time Magazine. And that suit went on for a long time and ultimately resulted in the case being dismissed and upheld by the United States Supreme Court. And cost a lot of money for absolutely no result. In fact, worse than no result, it resulted in the law becoming very much more difficult to sue a publication for supposed defamation. That... But because before that, Scientology used to file lawsuits pretty recklessly against the media. There was a number of Hubbard writings that said that that's something that should be done, that they should be sued.
Yeah.
There was a second thing that happened in the late 90s, which was when these OT3 materials appeared on the internet, there were a number of lawsuits that were filed against the individuals who had supposedly put them onto the internet. And I write about this in the book, that this was sort of Scientology's Vietnam. That was an unwinnable war against the internet, and those lawsuits were singularly failures, ultimately. And so there was a real reticence on the part of Scientology, and I was around then. There was a real reticence to file any more lawsuits against the media or about things on the internet or, you know, intellectual property violations and that sort of stuff. When Debbie Cook was sued in, I guess it was the beginning of 2012, it was on the basis that she had signed a non-disclosure agreement and a contractual obligation to not speak about Scientology.
Yep.
And she had sent an email out to various Scientologists saying, look, this whole thing has turned into a shit show. This isn't what L. Ron Hubbard says to do. They're taking your money, blah, 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 blah. And that did not please David Miscavige. And he went, well, wait a minute. I sent someone down there with a $50,000 check. And she signed this in exchange for that check, a lawyer. And they sued Debbie and her husband, Wayne, for violating that agreement. And Debbie actually called me and a guy called Marty Rathbun to say, you know, what should I do? Because I known Debbie since the day she arrived in the Sea Organization. I was her first boss.
Right.
And I was actually quite close to her and had known her for many, many years. But we hadn't spoken since she had left the Sea Org. She escaped the Sea Org too, but she continued to be a Scientologist.
And, right, okay.
Was actually had a business that was a public relations or media consulting business or something, and almost all her clients were Scientologists. She was a very, very famous person in Scientology. When she got sued, she was like, now nobody's going to talk to me. None of the Scientology people. My business is ruined, blah, 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 blah. Okay, call Mike. So I flew to Texas and met, that's where she was living, and met with Marty and found, and I sat down with Debbie and her husband, Wayne, and I said, look, you can fight this or you can fold your tent and you will... You know, probably nothing too dramatic will happen to you. A judge will issue an order saying that this is an enforceable agreement and that you were violated and you are now bound by a court order to not speak and or say anything in the future, or you can fight it. And if you choose to fight it, I will help you, but you're going to have to we're going to have to find a lawyer, we're going to have to prepare you to be able to testify, et cetera, et cetera. And she and her husband decided that their integrity was more important than their, you know, immediate happiness, because they knew this was going to be a terrible thing. So we found a lawyer, and the lawyer turned out to be a wonderful guy, and Debbie went on the stand, and Scientology thought that they were going to steamroll her because they move for a restraining order, which has a very short, 7 to 10 days before the hearing happens. And they figured she'll never find a lawyer. She'll never be able to get prepared. We will walk in, we will steamroll her, and then it will be over. And that didn't happen. And so subsequent to that, I have always said to people who have been worried about the agreements that they've signed with Scientology, take a look at the Debbie Cook case. She even got $50,000 and a video signed agreement, and they still bailed. And she didn't even finish her testimony before Scientology bailed and went, Your Honor, we've got all the evidence we need. They then settled. And so I don't think that Scientology is going to be in a hurry to file any lawsuits against anyone about anything. And they have not filed any lawsuits since, you know, trying to enforce agreements since Debbie Cook. They haven't filed any lawsuits against the media since, you know, the Time magazine era.
And that includes you guys? Nothing between you and Leah and them? You're all clear?
Yeah. Yep.
I think I remember Leah talking about the little disclaimer at the end of the episode being really annoying, because the disclaimer basically says, the Church of Scientology disputes these facts and figures, or at the start, whatever it is. How did you feel about that, about having your television network also put up a disclaimer to take some credibility away from what was being said?
See, I never thought it took away credibility.
Okay.
I was always a great proponent of reading out their stupid-ass letters and putting up their statements and going, see, we told you, these people are nuts. They say everybody is a liar. They say everybody is doing it for money. They say, we'll read you what they say about everybody, and you make up your own mind. Here is what they say about this person. And we started doing it at the top of episodes. Leah would read out their letters. Oh, yes, well, you know, blah, blah, blah is a liar and a thief and a blah, 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 blah. And then you watch the episode and you go, yeah, not so much. So I understood why they did it. I never felt like it really detracted from anything. Mm. To me, that whole series, the 37 episodes, put to rest the idea that Scientology has any credibility when it comes to seeking to discredit those who talk about its abuses.
I wonder as well, I was thinking about you and thinking about Al Gore the other day, funnily enough, because I'm looking over your, I guess it's your left shoulder, that little Emmy sitting back there, which is a nice little addendum to this work. And I'm sure the biggest part about doing that particular program was the good work you were doing, but there's some nice little rewards that have come with that as well, gratifying rewards. And I was thinking about when Al Gore lost that presidential election, and then he went on and got the Nobel Peace Prize and won an Oscar. I'm like, what would you rather be, the president or have, you know? And I was thinking, you know, so you guys go off and do other things. And on reflection, looking back, you must kind of go, well, this was a, I'm glad we did this for lots of reasons, for the good work primarily, but there's other things that must be lovely that are now a part of your life because of doing those things, the byproducts of those things.
Yeah. And you know what the biggest byproduct, Pat? The people that I met.
Yeah. Yeah.
The wonderful, amazing people that I met. That Emmy is a validation of all those people who appeared on our program and were brave enough to stand up and tell their stories. It really is. It means that the television community recognized that there was, you know, that what they were doing was important, that that them taking a stand was important, and their courage. And so, yeah. And I met a lot of wonderful people too, just not even just the ex-Scientologists, but a whole bunch of people from the Jehovah's Witnesses and from the Nation of Islam and like all these different sort of, and all these people that reached out to me. And, you know, I now have wonderful friendships with the people that were in NXIVM, because we're all sort of, you know, one in the, like the same kind of experiential history in our lives. And, you know, Mark Vicente and Sarah Edmondson, now I classify as good friends. And I reached out to them after watching The Vow, and Sarah and Mark both said, oh my God, you were our inspiration. And nice. That was like, oh, that is the stuff that like makes my day or week or year or life.
You talk about meeting people. I was thinking as well, I've written down the role of the Office of Special Affairs. And one of the job you did in that, or that the office did, was to kind of destroy the enemies of Scientology. And I imagine also to keep people in check within Scientology. Have you had any experiences since leaving Scientology? Like you're talking about the people, other ex-Scientologists that you meet and kind of binding. Have you met any other ex-Scientologists that are kind of like, I'm sorry, we can't get past what happened within Scientology around you? Like, have you had negative effects from previous Scientologists? Or is it, are you all really just, we're one, where we were all victims here and we're one coming together afterwards?
It's pretty much that. There are a couple of sort of exceptions to that, of people that sort of go, oh, well, he hasn't done X, Y, or Z, and so therefore he isn't really who he says he is, and he might still be working for OSA, like that sort of kind of flavor of thing. And but they're very, very few and far between. The vast majority of people are unbelievably kind and understanding, and I don't mean just ex-Scientologists. I mean, you know, like reporters that I dealt with, or people in government agencies that I dealt with, or, you know, anybody has been just so, so kind is just the right word. You know,
It's like
the world outside of Scientology, when you're in Scientology, is portrayed as this horrible, the wog world, full of wogs, the unwashed, the criminals, the psychiatrists, all these horrible people out there in this horrible world. And you get out here and it's like, there's just a lot of really nice people out there. Like, you know, you make friends all over the place, and they're decent decent folks, and you know, the neighbors are nice, and the guys.
Well, I mean, that's nice to hear, because I mean, like, I know it's not exactly the right number, and I think this is my last question because I know it's time for us to wrap up. But you're basically brainwashed for 50 years, and if someone's brainwashed for 50 years, you can't hold them too much to account for what they need to atone. But I guess my last question is going to be, as you were in that for so long, from 5 through to 50-ish, whatever the time period was, that's not 50 years, is it? Anyway, was there a singular moment? Like, was there a moment where you, I think I'm retelling Leah's story correctly, where she read the document and she was like, hang on. Was there a singular moment for you that you went, oh, hang on, this is not right? Or was it a progression for you to get to a point where you got out?
It was a progression, but then there was a singular moment, and I write about it in the book. It was when I was with John Sweeney, the reporter from the BBC in London, and he was asking me about being physically assaulted by David Miscavige, and I was denying it and telling him we were going to sue him and threatening him and this and that, and he's saying, but I have eyewitnesses that I believe, and I knew exactly who it was that he'd been talking to and exactly what they were saying, and they were telling him the truth and I was lying. And while I had been able to justify in my mind lying to Katie Couric about OT3 because I believed that might kill people to admit it, it sort of reached the point of, this isn't why I signed a billion-year contract, to defend this little shit from about who beats people at, you know, with reckless abandon. That's not why I'm here. That's not why I'm, you know, sacrificing myself 18 hours a day, 365 days a year, never seeing my family, blah, 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 blah. This is like, there's something really wrong. But even that, I still felt like I had an obligation to my children and my wife to not abandon them. And then Miscavige, of course, in his inimitable style, wrote a letter that said, I'm never coming back to the US. He's going to ship me off to Western Australia. He'll give me 10 quid. And if I can't survive on that, I can sell my body on the street. And I went, okay, there's nothing left for me. Nothing could be worse than this. And that was when I escaped.
That sounds pretty good. Western Australia, off to Perth, get that Fremantle doctor coming through. That's not that bad. Good cricket ground out there, by the way, Mike, just to go full circle with our conversation.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, look, it's been an absolute pleasure to be talking to you today. As I do with all my conversations, when she decides to show up in my studio, I do like to introduce people to my dog. So there's my dog. She's in the studio with me right now, having a lie down. Border collie. Nala. Hey.
Oh.
There she is.
Oh, she is gorgeous.
Yeah. It's my little border collie.
She's gorgeous.
She turns 2 in 2 weeks' time, and she likes to hang out in the studio with me. And so I often say to people, do you want to meet my dog? And they always say, yep. And so now I just go, now I'm just arrogant enough to go, here's my dog. And
here's my dog, yeah. You need to meet my dog.
Yeah. Yeah. So there you go. You beat my dog.
Well, I should bring mine in, but
totally.
She's like not likely to be as well behaved as that.
Oh, she's lazy. That's because she was at the park this morning. I have to run her twice a day because she's a border collie. So she's had her morning run, and that's why she's lying down sleeping right now.
Well, ours is probably part border collie. She's a mutt. She's a rescue dog, and she is very cute, but somewhat mischievous.
Mike, it's been an absolute pleasure. I was so, so excited to have a chat with you, as you can hear. I mean, to be honest with you, we could probably go for another hour, but we're not going to. Maybe that can be our conversation 2.0 when the next book comes out.
Okay.
But it's been an absolute pleasure. I've enjoyed spending some time with you, and I very, very appreciate you giving us some time. I'm sure your time is still incredibly precious, and media all over the world is connecting with you to come and talk about your book. So to remind people of that, of course, the book is A Billion Years, My Escape from a Life in the Highest Ranks of Scientology, and it can be purchased all over the world. It's available in New Zealand, all over New Zealand. The one that I found out of interest was fishbond.co.nz. If people are interested in it, Mike Rinder, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Pat. Yep, a real pleasure.